position number 21583, wheel 2.
Frank Moore, reel 2.
These thieves came from an Arab village which was within sight under the mountains, the edge of the plain. And they were so clever, extremely difficult to catch. And I understand that one night the commanding officer arranged that about 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that, searchlights and headlights were switched on all round at the corners, and it was like flushing rabbits out of a cornfield, but these young chaps were naked and greased, so you couldn't get hold of them. And I believe that afterwards, because this was, I heard this afterwards, that they sent a troop of soldiers over to the village, and they took all the livestock from the Arabs, the villagers, and they couldn't exist without them. And apparently they said, now you give our kit back, you put the kit in some compound, and we'll give you your animals back. And I believe most of the kit got back. But I went into my tent after having a awful session with some Newfoundland officers who asked me whether I could play poker or not, and I said no, I couldn't. And they said, would you teach me? I did play a little bit of poker, and they took all my month's advance of pay off me in about half an hour, and then said I couldn't afford to buy a drink, so they got me fairly drunk. And I staggered back to my tent, which is in the middle of these 46 rows of tents one way and 23 the other, or something like that, quite hard to find, which I shared with a captain who had been on Alexander's staff. And I must have staggered into the tent. In the meantime, a thief had got in and I think stolen most of his stuff, but hadn't touched mine. So I was quite glad of that, because I'm not sure whether he was left anything to get dressed in the next morning. I can't remember, but I remember the fury that he found that he'd been burgled, as it were, in the tent, in the middle of this lot of tents, in the middle of the night. But that, those were the conditions. Now, then I heard that the regiment, the division, in fact, had gone to Italy. They'd gone by landing ship, and they had a pretty rough journey, I believe. So I managed to hitchhike an aeroplane back to Sousse by finding an RAF chap and said, will you give me a lift? And there was an old Albemarle, which was an awful old plane, which we used a bit for glider towing and parachuting. And I got back to my regiment, which had a rear party. A small party were left always to clear up and get the heavy transport and this sort of thing when at any time a unit moved. And I went to Tunis to get a priority pass to get over to Italy. And they said, oh, you know, everybody's going for priority. Oh, we might have to wait 2 or 3 weeks and so on. So I was fed up with that. So I went to an American airfield at Bizerta and showed my identity thing. I mean, the Americans hadn't a clue who I was. I mean, they took any identity. And I waited till the Dakotas were flying in and went to the pilot and said, where are you going next? And I found one who said he was going to Naples. I said, well, that's Italy. That will do me somehow. And then I found another one a little later who was going to Bari, which is on the right-hand side, the east of Italy. And so I said, would you give me a lift? And he said, yes. So I just put my kit in and got there. And my regiment, it might have been Foggia he was going to, Foggia, which was a little bit north of Bari. My regiment was in a place called Campobasso. And how I got there, I don't recall, but you thumbed a lift or persuaded someone to give you a lift, but I did catch up with my regiment at this place called Campo Basso, and they had had a real quite an exciting time. I'd missed the first 2 weeks, I think, when they were chasing the Germans up the spine of Italy to the Germans were retreating and blowing up every bridge and blowing up every village and that sort of thing as they left, making it extremely difficult. And we were, because we had these little mountain guns, we were up in the mountains a lot. We did our own mine clearing, and we fought with the 1st Canadian Division. They were very complimentary about us. I show you a quote from them that they said, these airborne gunners don't give a bugger about anything. You know, they'll, and we sort of got mixed up on the wrong side of the Germans sometimes. It was a very fluid situation. It was very interesting in a way. And I remember these bits of Italy, but we were moving and going from village, or what was left of villages. We found some tragic things because the Germans booby-trapped our houses, and then when the Italians, particularly Italian children, tried to get back, you know, they got badly wounded. I remember one of our medical chaps trying to sort of more or less put the stomach back into some poor Italian child who just tried to get back in his home, and a booby trap exploded. And one village, I think about 2,000 people, where I don't think there was a single roof left on their houses. The Germans had blown all the roofs, you know, all the shelter, to deny us shelter. And eventually we got up to the River Sangro, where the Germans were pretty well fortified, and my regiment was scattered in a way. We up in the mountains. My troop was separated even from the other troop in our battery. The Germans weren't very far away. In fact, when some of our men went out to try and scrounge for pigs or something like that, because, you know, they, anything food, anything that walked with food with no owner about, both sides were trying to get. And our little party went out and suddenly found the Germans being talked just over the hedge. You know, it was quite a sort of mix-up. And on Christmas Day in 1943, we got our cooks and batmen out, and we fired 5 rounds gunfire onto the German headquarters, and I gather did quite a lot of damage. And from 5 minutes to midnight till 5 minutes past midnight on New Year's Eve, the Germans fired back at us. So we thought they at least had a sort of sense of humour. But we had some casualties, not many. One of my colleagues got an MC, and he was holed up in some house when he ended up by having to shoot his pistol down the stairs at the German attacking him. And my battery commander, he had a fascinating time in the church tower, and he got directed the whole divisional artillery onto where the Germans were doing it, formed up to do a real big dangerous counterattack. There was a little note, because he had his career written about too. He kind of came from Suffolk. And he was up in the church spire, and, you know, they were under fire, and he was busting for a pee, and he said he had a pee over the edge, and you know, his colleague said, "Dennis, look out, you might get it shot off." And so it was that sort of war. It was really quite exciting. Sometimes we were shelled. I remember washing in the snow. We had a canvas buckets to wash in, a sort of half a bucket of cold water, and one said to try and do a stand-up wash, and I got myself out clean, and I was just getting my pulling my trousers up when the Germans opened fire with artillery, and it was fortunately very soft. It had been ploughed land, and the shells were landing only a few yards away, but beyond us. But I remember jumping into a slit trench, and a soldier jumped in behind and pushed all the soil from the edge down my trousers, and I was just pulling them up. So I had to go through the washing business again. But these were the things you thought were funny. It was, you know, one had a laugh about them. We ended up static, in a way, for about a month in the mountains. It got very snowy. In fact, we should have pulled out to go back to England before we did, and we couldn't get out. We had 3 feet of snow. We were absolutely snowed in time. But our particular gun, 75 millimeter pack howitzers, had a different form of ammunition to the tank guns, the 75 millimeter tanks, American tanks, which was used on the Sherman tanks. And we had virtually run out of ammunition. They hadn't got it enough in Italy, so we were put in a role that, you know, if the Germans didn't attack, we kept quiet, and if as long as we didn't attack up there, the Germans kept quiet, more or less. That was the role at the time. But we should have got out a little earlier. And eventually we pulled out, came down to southern Italy. We handed over all our guns and jeeps to another unit. One of the batteries, although they formed a battery, which joined part of this 1st Airborne Division, including the infantry. They formed an independent airborne brigade, which ended up in Greece, in fact. But we went back to England. We caught a troop ship. We boarded a troop ship in Taranto and sailed back to England. The only thing that I remember, again, I was a bad sailor, was the troop ship was lousy. I mean, lice, infested with lice, and inspecting the seams of the men's underwear and the Bay of Biscay and in the troop decks, which were pretty sort of niffy anyway, was not a pleasant job if you're feeling seasick. And we ended up in, landed in on the Clyde at Glasgow, just down the Clyde, virtually at the same time as the Queen Elizabeth came in with, or Queen Mary, sorry, with 17,000 American troops each time. And we met a few of the Americans. Incidentally, we had met some of the American Airborne Divisions. There was an 82nd on the 101 American Airborne Divisions, which had been in North Africa, quite close to us. Also, Popsky's Private Army had been quite close. I mean, there was a lot of troops. We were living in North Africa, not in tented accommodation. We lived under, because there was no rain, we lived in olive groves, and we put the mosquito nets on the olive trees and so on. The only tents, I think we had a marquee of a cookhouse and that sort of thing, but it was all in the open. But the Americans had a The American airborne divisions thought less of their American pilots at the time than we did, because the American pilots in Sicily frankly got a bad reputation, because it was alleged that the first time they saw ACAC fire, they cast the gliders off, and that's from the tug end, from the American tug, the pilot's end, because it's the glider pilot who should cast off when he knows he's there, which you can sort of press a button on the rope that is still tied to the tug. And I gather it was the other way around in Sicily, and an awful lot of gliders landed in the sea. And there was, we didn't think much of those pilots. So I think, what's, to be fair to them, they were civilian pilots, sort of pushed into uniform, and really didn't have any military training. Whereas, you see, our glider pilots were essentially soldiers who'd been taught how to fly, and the glider pilot regiment were absolutely marvelous, wonderful people. Anyway, to continue, we got back at the end of January 44, and our base was Boston in Lincolnshire. My regiment was stationed in Boston, and that was the base virtually till the end of the war. Of course, we were off and away. We went on exercises, went up to firing ranges in Northumberland, Reedsdale, and Seney Bridge, and so on. But the people of Boston were wonderful to us. I always said it was a wonderful troops town. There were two dance halls and four cinemas and 83 pubs, and the girls used to whistle at us. As we say, that not all the girls used to whistle at us, but today it was a jolly good place to be stationed in, although it was fairly tough going in those days. There wasn't, there was a lot of weak beer, and, but we were treated very, very well. And later on, the people of Boston produced a wonderful sort of inscribed oak thing that went on the altar in this Oosterbeek Church in Arnhem, which listed all the names of my regiment who were killed at Arnhem. And they were terribly good to us. Well, we trained from February, March, April, May, and on D-Day, we were not the division that landed in France. 6th Airborne did that. We went down to the airfields in Gloucestershire. We went to Broadwell Airfield, because most of the airborne fields were round Gloucestershire. Some were in Kent, Manston, Kent, and some, I think, in East Anglia. We were spread around, and we were going, I think, the next day, virtually. We were all ready to go in as a second wave. But I believe the first operation, they were going to land us on right on top of a German ACAC regiment, which wouldn't have been much good. Possibly that way was cancelled. And then thereafter, we were briefed for 16 or 17, I think the Arnhem job was the 17th operation. And briefing meant that you were locked up in these air transit camps. You were briefed on what had to be done, and then the operation was cancelled. Very largely after the breakout from Caen in Normandy, because the ground troops got there without needing us. And we were getting a bit frustrated. And this went on till September. And about 10 days before we went to Arnhem, we were again down at the airfield, down Ampney in Gloucestershire. And we were briefed on an operation which the 1st Airborne Division was going to do the whole of what turned out to be the Arnhem Operation Market Garden. One brigade was going to land at Grave, which was the southern area where the American 101 Airborne Division landed. One brigade was going to land at Nijmegen, and the 1st Parachute Brigade was going to land at Arnhem. And my particular battery, who supported the 1st Parachute Brigade, we were actually going to land at Nijmegen, and with our 38 glider pilots swung up the road to support the parachutists who had landed on the bridge at Arnhem, which was that particular rose where they knocked the Guards Armoured Division out, as it turned out. But this was cancelled, thank heavens, because I don't think anybody would have survived. And then 10 days later, we actually were briefed for the Arnhem operation. In between, funnily enough, it's really digressing, it shows a small world that three of us took a jeep. We thought we'd go to a pub or something like that, and we were driving down the road, and there were three gorgeous girls in uniform. They were Fannies, which was the ambulance drivers or something like that, and two had Ireland on the shoulder flashes, and one had Canada. Well, my eldest half-brother been to Canada, or lived in Canada and married a Canadian, and I sat in the back with a very attractive girl, and poor thing, she was actually married, and she'd come over, she joined the forces, come over to meet her, met up with her husband, and she'd arrived the day after he'd been gone to Norway, to Normandy, so she hadn't seen him yet, but they were all great fun. And I said to her, it's rather like asking if you come from London, you know anybody called Jim Smith, and I said, you don't know anybody called Tom Moore, and she turned out to be one of his old girlfriends. So, you say, it's a small world, but it was quite a bit entertaining. But anyway, we were briefed for the Arnhem operation, and I was very lucky that I actually was able to go on it, because I was the sort of junior subaltern in the battery, and we were limited in the number of people. And the chap who should have gone, who was a great friend of mine, wild, mad as a hatter, had decided to take a bottle of whiskey to his mother, who was lived in Lincolnshire, and he'd driven himself into a roadblock and badly damaged himself and was in hospital. So I went to Arnhem instead of him. So I always felt delighted, very pleased I got the chance. And about 2 hours before we took off, which we took off from Fairford, these were Stirling bombers pulling these Horsa gliders, which were wonderful things, in which we had either a jeep and two trailers of ammunition or equipment, or a jeep and a trailer and a gun, and a gun detachment. And about 2 hours before we took off, my battery commander said, look, I want you to change gliders because I want you to get there earlier to help organize the rendezvous and so on. The glider I should have traveled in fact, the vehicle, whatever it was, a sort of truck that pulled them into place, I think backed into its wheel and bent it. And we had a reserve glider, and the chaps had to change and unload and put the jeep and trailers into this reserve glider. And they took off late. And We never really knew whether they were shot down on the way or whether the tug was going a bit fast, because the stalling speed of a Stirling was alleged to be almost the if they went too fast, they pulled the wings off the glider or something like that. But the glider with my men, I should have travelled in, they were all killed. The glider was either shot, the wings were shot off or they pulled off. We never really quite knew. There were sort of two stories about it. So that was my second lucky escape from being in the wrong glider. I used to be quite airsick in gliders. They were terrible, you know, particularly if you hit somebody's slipstream. But for the first time, we had airsick pills, hyoscine hydrobromide pills. Normally, I had to lie on the floor to stop being sick. So I didn't see anything much when we got, you could see a lot. But actually, I really enjoyed that flight. The first glider flight, I really enjoyed. And it was quite interesting, certainly flying over England. And I think it was somewhere near Harwich. There was a huge airfield where the runway was almost as sort of wide as it was long, which I think is where all these disabled bombers used to crash land to get home. And you could see, and looking at the from the air, you could almost feel you could step from airfield to airfield. The country was covered in airfields. Quite astonishing. You were never out of sight of an airfield, and we were only flying at 2,000 feet, something like that. It was fascinating. And then when we got over Holland, there was a certain amount of flak, and we had fighter escorts who were going down, shooting up these flak sites, because Holland had been flooded quite extensively, and so the German AKAC guns were on the sort of banks or the dike sides and things like that. But you felt sorry for the Dutch. I mean, this wonderful farmland was all underwater. It looked awful. And then when we got near Arnhem, of course, it's a little bit higher. It's a different sort of country altogether than the Polderland. It was quite exciting because we felt we could see Germany. We could almost, from the air, you were only sort of 5 or 10 miles away. I've forgotten the border is quite close. And when we came into land, my glider pilot said, I can't land where we're supposed to because the glider's all over the place. And I went and we landed actually in the sugar beet field and had a very good landing. And then I did a stupid thing, because during training we had to load the gliders from the front, drive the jeeps in, and you had to put channel iron down on the channels on the floor so the jeeps didn't go through the floor. And they had to be lashed down and blocked, because if they got vibration, they'd break loose and that sort of thing. It's quite an interesting, quite a job you had to do. And during training, we had to get them out of the same way, because the early gliders, the nose didn't open out, so you can drive in and out of the same place. But when we went to war, we were allowed to take the tail off, which was held by four coach bolts, only about 3/8-inch coach bolts. But we'd never done this before, and of course I did it the wrong way. I undid the top two, and the tail plane went like this, and of course trapped the ones that were underneath that I had to should have undone first, if anybody had told me. You couldn't get at the bloody things. So we had a little fire axe, and we were being shot at a bit at the time, sniped. And I remember sort of desperately chopping the glider to bits so we could roll the tailplane away and get the jeep out, which we did, in fact, and it was all right. And we were on the wrong side of the railway line at Arnhem, and we went under the the railway lines, there's a sort of way under, and joined the regiment. And we went, the guns went into action positions there, and it was the first time we were shelled by these German naval Werfer thing, this which were sort of rocket things in a way that they didn't do very much damage. It was the first time I remember hearing them. And then